How much of the Buddha? How much of the Dharma? How much of the Sangha? So, I actually picked the topic of this talk, practicing with fear, before hearing about the first confirmed Portland case of coronavirus. So I thought, well, dang, right on then. It goes without saying that there are many potential sources of fear in our world right now. I mean, there has been, since the beginning of humankind, sources of fear. Sometimes situations are more fear-inducing than others. For myself, I feel fear about what's going to happen around our climate and ecological crisis. I feel fear around the undermining of our democracy through voter suppression and corporate money in politics and breaking down the balance of different institutions of our government. And I have to say, I didn't really fear coronavirus until, you know, I read that somebody in Portland had been a confirmed case, and I just felt this kind of wave go through my body, you know, which is like, and I'm not inclined to panic or hysteria or anything, but it was just this, you know, at a certain level, fear is the most, one of the most basic responses that we have, that it's kind of, it's physical, it, in a way, to some extent, it's natural, and we can't even really do anything about that first kind of, ooh, feeling that fear. So, in Buddhism, a big part of our practice is acknowledging our emotions and experiences, but then not being controlled by them, or practicing in such a way that we are not controlled by them. So, you know, there's other emotions, experiences that we do this with. Anger, for instance. Now, anger, at the most basic level, is a sense that something that we care about or ourselves is being threatened. So that there's that response of anger, okay. And then it's like, at a very basic level, I'm experiencing anger. Is there something I need to pay attention to here? Sometimes we feel a lot of desire or excitement about something. Something needs to happen, or I really want this to happen, or whatever. And that can be something that we can end up being controlled by. But noticing that, and there may be something that we really should do or move toward. So there's, it's not that we're trying to get rid of emotions or deny that they might have some kind of valid origin. We may have like worry or some kind of narrative that something's not right with our life, and we could end up being controlled by that kind of anxiety. Or we can acknowledge the anxiety and notice, you know, okay, is there something that I need to pay attention to? You know, fear for ourselves, our loved ones, what we love is very basic and really is under most of our other emotions and motivations. So in Buddhism, as recently in Tuesdays, we were talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, and this fits right with that, where we acknowledge, we become mindful of our emotion, in this case, fear. And that's in the sense that I use the analogy of binoculars, and mindfulness is bringing something into view, is to recall what it is that we want to pay attention to and then kind of keep it in view. So in a sense, we are, when we become mindful of our fear, we're you know, bringing that into our view. We're paying attention to our fear. I'm experiencing fear. Like I said, when I felt that kind of, you know, wave go through me, huh, there's some fear. And so we're shifting our focus from the object, the subject of our fear, to the fear itself. So it's not thinking about, in this case, the coronavirus and all the terrible things that could happen. It's noticing my fear. And noticing it without really any particular judgment or agenda, even though we may want to overcome our fear, we may want to not be angry, we may want to not feel anxious. But this first step of really becoming mindful of it really has to just be, we're not trying to get rid of it, because then we can't really experience it or see it for what it is if we're just trying to get rid of it. And this very process can be powerful in and of itself. And why that is, I mean, don't really need to know why it works, but I mean, part of it, probably because we're once again shifting our attention from something over which we have little control, something we might be fearful of, something that's happening in the world, something that might happen, and we have limited control over that, and we're shifting it toward our own experience, our own body-mind, which we don't have exactly complete control over, but we do have some influence there. We do have some matter of choice in terms of our own body and mind and behavior. So, then what? We may have little choice about whether and how something like fear arises. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know how any of you are feeling about this particular, you know, the coronavirus thing. But, you know, typically we might wake up in the middle of the night, kind of obsessing about our fear. Or we may find ourselves kind of morbidly obsessed with it and needing to, like, read about it, kind of like we're staring at an accident or something, right? Kind of just... we may have just, you know, anxiety that appears throughout the day around it. Or kind of catastrophizing and imagining all the terrible things that could happen. So once we recognize our fear, we have some choices about what to do next. Again, we can dwell on the subject of our fear, which usually only inflames the fear, sometimes not. Sometimes, you know, properly informing yourself can actually decrease the fear. But the important thing is that we're paying attention to what happens, you know, as we are supposedly informing ourselves. You know, if there's some danger or risk, obviously we need to inform ourselves to some extent. But how much? You know, what does unnecessary dwelling look like? And that's probably going to, you know, be different for each person or different at different times. I would imagine probably not the smartest thing to go watch a movie tonight about pandemics, you know, like probably not the best thing for sleeping well. So, and interestingly, this kind of ties into crisis Buddhism, which is a formulation of practice that I've been working on lately, where we have three areas of practice: bearing witness, taking action, and taking care of ourselves and our lives. And of course, this kind of mindfulness of our own fear, informing ourselves about what's going on, is the bearing witness part of this. And so we always have to do that in balance with these other things, including taking care of ourselves. Outright denial doesn't generally work, and you're not very helpful to other people if you're just in denial. But we can be skillful about how much we bear witness and how and where we get our facts from and, you know, that kind of thing. And watch the effect it has on us. But be also be part of bearing witness is recognizing that paying attention to this stuff to some extent is not going to be pleasant. It's not something we do because it's fun. It's something we do because it's part of our responsibility and for ourselves and for others. So it's kind of it's work, and it's not necessarily pleasant, but we also don't have to be obsessed. So then the other parts of crisis Buddhism, you know, there's taking care of ourselves. So in the midst of fear and anxiety, continuing to take care of ourselves in general ways. I saw an epidemiologist on Bill Maher last night, and she was just saying, you know, just eat well, take care of yourself, like all these kind of basic things that can just, you know, help us all be more prepared. Spend time with loved ones, relax, you know, that kind of thing. But also to, in this taking care of ourselves, this choice that this, you know, fear isn't going to control me or dictate my life. So, you know, there's the Howard Hughes example of kind of, I mean, if we really thought about all the germs in the world, we would just lock ourselves into some kind of sterile room and like do nothing and touch no one and go nowhere. And I mean, life is risky. And not only that, like we can survive more than we think. And also, you know, so we're not, these choices about this fear is not going to control me or dictate my life. And it's not going to, I'm not going to dehumanize those we irrationally think might be more likely to be sick. Nobody's visiting Chinatown in San Francisco. I mean, is that how we want to be? I don't want to be that way. To, you know, at what point are we going to avoid activities that make our lives worth living? Coming to Sangha? No. I mean, each of us has to make these choices, but that's part of this process of taking care of ourselves and our lives and, you know, deciding, you know, what's reasonable and what don't we want to give up? And to keep sitting. Sitting helps us be more sane. Mindfulness, you know, moment by moment off the cushion. This sense of, you know, we can think of all the terrible things that might happen. And yet, if we breathe and we're present in our body and we're present with what is right now, I mean, right now, we're okay. And chances are, for most of us, even if we got COVID-19, we might feel shitty, but we would be okay. I mean, so it's kind of that checking in with our physical reality, even though our mind is capable of a lot of anticipation and imagination and stuff like that, to check in with this very basic level of feeling safe and okay. So that's another powerful practice, even though it's very simple. And then there's our taking action piece. How are we going to respond? You know, if there's, I mean, we have to question our own fear. Is there a good reason for our fear? And, you know, sometimes yes. But my example of working with fear that I just totally impressed on me. So I was camping all alone in the woods. I enjoyed doing that alone. And I'm, you know, in my tent, and I hear rustling in the bushes. And I mean, I knew there was a rapist out there, but I just, what was I going to do? You know, like, I didn't want to go running out there to see if there was, but what if there was? And like, so I watched this fear just, you know, arise. And then, you know, every sound is just a confirmation. And I don't know, there was just this point at which I just said, like, well, nothing I can do about it, even if there is. So let's just, like, I don't know, somehow was able to kind of let go of that fear. And of course, I mean, there was nothing. It was probably a mouse. But our minds can tell us, you know, that there's something to be really fearful of. So we can question that. I mean, I've read some great things lately about, you know, how the human mind works and how we focus on the negative and exaggerate risk. And when it's unknown, it's even scarier and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, to question our own minds in terms of the fear and the legitimacy of our fear. But okay, if there's a danger or a risk, is there anything we can do about it? And there are a few things that we can do, which we'll get to in a moment, but to a large extent, there's nothing we can do. And our practice really can help us live with that fact, deal with that fact, in a very practical sense. So one of our six perfections, so there's like generosity and moral behavior, and one of them is forbearance or tolerance. And I think of this as just so great, because Buddhism essentially admits that even if you're really good at this practice, there's going to be uncomfortable times. There's going to be times when no matter what you do with your own mind or you let go of or anything, there's going to be difficult times. So part of our practice is learning to just be with that, to just forbear and not have to react. So I can imagine in this circumstance, this is going to be, you know, I mean, maybe not, but it looks pretty likely over the next few weeks to a month or whatever, there's going to be periods of like fear arising and anxiety arising and, you know, things that we can react to, and it's not going to feel great. But also in a certain sense, also cultivating a sense that even with all of that, that we're okay. We can be a little bit bigger than all of that stuff. So in terms of what we can do, what is reasonable, what is responsible but doesn't feed fear or divide us. Somebody just told me at the tea break, there's a really long line at Costco. That and I felt another wave of that fear, right? It's like it's not like I'm not even so much afraid of the virus at this point. I'm not afraid of what people are going to do, you know, how crazy people are going to get. Ugh. So, you know, there's that, you know, what is reasonable? I mean, and then when I hear that, I'm kind of like, oh shit, I got to get out shopping, you know, because like, we could just feed off of each other, right? I don't know. So we can all make our own choices, but, you know, because almost anything that you do can also, like, kind of feed the fear a little bit as well. And yet, you know, I mean, so I feel like, you know, following the basic, I saw two emails go out today from other Zen centers about, like, you know, about this and taking precautions. And so I was like, okay, fine, I'll just kind of cut and paste one of them and send them out to our email list. And, you know, I mean, it was just like, all right, so what, you know, what's the middle way? I don't really want to be in a room full of everybody wearing face masks. That's just not, exactly. I mean, unless, like, you're sick, in which case you should be staying home. So that is one of the things. It's just like, okay, well, here's the precautions. It said, if you are feeling unwell, please stay home. Which is a little bit more, you know, because this is just a little bit more extreme than the illnesses that we're used to. So we take a little bit more precaution. So please stay home. And, you know, how about, you know, wash your hands, you know, put some hand sanitizer out so that if you realize you've touched a lot of doorknobs and, you know, blown your nose or something like that, maybe put some hand sanitizer on before you grab a cookie. I mean, another thing I thought of was kind of along the lines, because bleach gets really messy, like it'll spill on people, and that if we all like brought a coffee mug from home for tea and we had a little tray, and then you could wash your own coffee mug, which I heard soap kills this virus. It actually like dissolves. Am I right?
That is correct.
Okay.
The surface is such that it soaps of any sort, so anything basic can penetrate it, and it opens it up. So it lyses it, it kills it.
All right. So soap kills it. But even just a little extra added precaution, just that, you know, you have your own mug, you wash it, you're good. But then, yeah.
One easy way to just reduce your contact with people is doing namaste instead of shaking hands. I know it's like very natural for us to just put out our hands. And this is very easy, and it's also respectful, and it's, you know, you don't have to think much.
Bill Maher do that last night on his show. He wasn't shaking people's hands. He was going like this. And I mean, I spent some time in India, and like, that's a lovely way of greeting. I kind of wish we did that more often, because, you know, usually shaking hands is just when you're like being introduced or something. But, you know, just passing somebody on the street, just, you know. Yeah, so like, okay, maybe we do that.
Specific distances as well, and it's still fine.
Yeah, it's respectful, it's nice, so maybe doing that. And to remember that also when we are doing this, when we are, you know, washing and wiping down handles, or we're doing namaste instead of shaking hands, that we're doing this to protect each other. You could be carrying the virus, and you might be passing it to somebody else. So anyway, it's kind of like the attitude that we can have while we do this. And then there's another kind of action, which, you know, may not be relevant now, but maybe relevant in the near future, when those who are sick need our help, or our Sangha needs our help, or our patients or clients or family, and it requires us to go out into some degree of risk. I'm thinking right now about all the healthcare workers. Can you imagine if you were, I mean, you don't gonna have a choice. You're going to just be right there in the middle of it. So this, I don't know, this attitude of courage, which, you know, I'm sure you're all familiar with, like, courage isn't about having no fear. It's about taking action even though you feel fear. So if you imagine if you were the sick person, and if somebody was actually willing to come in and like touch you on the shoulder or something, you know, how sweet and connecting that would be. And I honestly, like, the scariest parts of this for me are reading about the, you know, what people experienced in Wuhan when they were locked down and isolated and alone. And, you know, that's what's like, oh, that's just so, so sad. So how do we arouse that courage? It's not an easy thing, but this is where all of these kinds of practices, I mean, all of these life situations, they all get back down to our spiritual practice. This is like this can be a koan for us. Where do we arouse that courage? Where do we find that sense that ultimately everything will be okay no matter what happens? You know, can we really, do we really feel that? Or do we feel that at moments? Is that a sense that we can deepen with our practice? Because they say that the Bodhisattva, this is from the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines, the Bodhisattva stands firmly without a support or a basis. So really, the confidence, the stability does not come from, you know, any rational place, or like, well, I'm going to be fine, or whatever. There's a stability that is based on, I guess you could say, faith in our practice, from life itself. I remember very early on in my practice, I'm not so anxious about flying that I can't do it, but I really don't like it. Really just like And I realized early on that one of the things that I really didn't like was the fact that if the plane started to go down, the last few minutes of my life would be spent in, like, abject terror. Like, what? You know, like, and that was like, I don't want it to end like that. That sucks. And then as I practiced a little more and I kind of got my mind around this, I was like, huh, all right. Practice is not getting me to the place where I would not be in abject terror. But practice is getting me to the place where that would be okay. It would be like, dang. Ah! I mean, what do you expect? Going down in a plane. I mean, where it somehow that, you know, the fact that we might experience that does not delegitimize our life, does not delegitimize our practice. So, so I guess this, I just throw this out there as something you might contemplate, as just this hopefully from your practice, from our faith, and by faith, I mean, you know, like Christians have a faith and Muslims have a faith and, you know, people of faith, whether we like it or not, of this kind of just this unconditional sense that things will be okay. And for us, it's not based on, you know, God will deliver us or we'll end up going to heaven. And, you know, it's not based on that kind of thing. It's based on a very different relationship to life, that there's a way that it can be okay no matter what. And
relationship to life and death.
Yeah.
That's what then.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's not just like death. It's
and sometimes, probably all the time, death makes life more real. I mean, that was one of the things I was struck by in India, that, you know, unlike here, which we managed to keep everything so safe and controlled, and anybody who's dying or ill, we usually manage, not so much with our homelessness problem lately, but and we manage to keep that compartmentalized. And in India, it's just kind of more right there. It's pretty obvious. When I was there, I passed several fatal accidents. And there's just bodies out on the road. And like, so I encountered death much more often and bodies burning on the ghats and stuff like that. And I don't know. I mean, it made me feel more alive. It made me appreciate being alive more. I don't know. So, yeah.
So I like to think about death specifically as a release, and then life goes on. Whether you're part of the universe's life or not, it's not up to you. That, you know, and it's an answer to also whether there'll be enough human beings or not, or whether the earth will survive. Well, you know, life will go on. It might not be in your space. It will be somewhere else.
And that's, you know, that doesn't mean we won't be sad or scared or do our best to avert things. But it's a weird kind of solace. It is, and if you don't relate to it, I understand. But you know, what does this actually look like? And I don't know. I just thought I would share with you what I'm thinking. And I mean, this is all aspiration. None of us really know how we're going to act, what we're going to do when faced with a really challenging, scary situation. But be my intention, unless I am sick, to come here, you know, every Tuesday and Sunday, no matter what. I mean, unless they don't let us, unless there's a lockdown, right? Which I hope there's not. And I think hopefully that the experts are starting to realize that kind of containment is not necessarily helpful. I don't know, there's a part of me that I am ready to risk my life. I am not ready to pointlessly be careless. But yeah, there's if there is need in order to continue to live this life in a meaningful way, to get back to the beginning, I don't want fear to control me and control my life. And there's plenty of aspects of practice that can help me not do that. So I will open it up to comments and questions.
One of the things I was thinking about fear, I have certain irrational fears that have been with me for so long that they're practically compulsions. And one of the things that I notice is that there are things you can do to appease the fear instead of facing it.
Mm.
Things that you can do that make you feel better about the fear rather than just letting the fear be and accepting the fear.
Mm.
That is specifically counterproductive because appeasing the fear means there's something real that needs to be appeased. It makes the thing that you're afraid of more real, more present, more demanding. It reinforces it. It's one of the things that I constantly struggle with because it's so counterintuitive. So I just wanted to put that out there.
But it might be the only step you're emotionally okay with.
Sure.
And that's fine too, right?
Although I think
it absolutely does need to continue.
And what I'm picturing is like running to Costco after this could possibly be a way to kind of temper. And again, no judgment if you're heading to Costco, it's okay. But if you're doing it, it's oh
shit.
Store
because you get so much more beans and lentils, and that will last you for years.
You're
going
to run out of
vegetables
very soon. Not beans and lentils, they'll stay forever. And I was thinking very specifically about masks. Right? Yeah. Because the surgical masks are not preventative unless you're sick.
Right?
They're preventative for other people. So hoarding them might make you feel better.
Mm.
I have specifically addressed that. It is extremely important not to hoard, not to buy unless you're not sick. It's please, if you can actually, if you have some, give it to sanitation workers more than healthcare workers, because at least healthcare workers know what they're doing and they're aware of their risk. Sanitation workers are just forced to do what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, and they might not have access to $80 masks, which is what it's going at. 2 years back, I had to buy this thing. It was at $10. Just letting you know how fast this thing has rocketed up. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
And it specifically won't help you vis-a-vis the continuation of your fear.
Yeah.
So, I was just thinking about fear being present. I had really wanted to go to this weekend at Great Vow around taming the inner critic, and as you know, I can't go. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do to tame my inner critic? So I recall the name that I was called as a child by an adult, and I had decided to call her that. And I invite her in, just like the Rooney poem, and we sit down at the table, I make her some tea, and whenever she starts yammering away, I picture gigantic cookies, and I just stuff her mouth. And so, Mark has given me the idea that I can do that with you as well.
Mm.
Just let her come in, let her have some tea, she's here.
Mentally, you can heap her with masks. and herbal remedies and whatever that she wants.
And stuff her mouth full of cookies.
So one thing that seems to me that I'm saying to myself, so I thought I'd just say it out loud, is reasonable caution doesn't need to be thrown out the window. So if I feel compelled to wash my hands again with soap and water and sing happy birthday 2 times, I can do that. And it doesn't, that is a caution. And it is, and it's soap and you can do it. So I think sometimes to rely on my practice makes sense. But to wash my hands with soap and water makes sense. And so somehow the reasonable caution thing came to my mind as You don't have to throw all controversy.
What was your name again?
Wayne.
Wayne had his hand up. Yeah.
Yeah, I must hesitate to bring this up because I think I'll see people start to move away from me.
Oh.
I actually lived in Beijing during the whole SARS epidemic.
Uh-huh.
Including the day it was announced that it came out, right?
Huh.
That before that, there had been rumors and flu and that kind of thing. Yeah. And all I can tell you is when you're, and I don't know what it is about fear, if you're on the inside of it, and in fact, even where I live, they built the new quarantine hospital, it was only like a couple blocks away. All I can say is, hearing about the person in Hillsborough that's here at Hillsborough bothered me more than that. And I can't explain why, but if you're on the inside of something, so we took 3 days off, and we got thermometers out, and took everybody's temperature when they came to work, and it was like life went on because
right. So actually,
this was it. This was life.
Actually, being in the middle of it wasn't necessarily as bad as the anticipation and fear.
Maybe it was bad, but you just got on with it. Some reason, even the one in Hillsborough kind of bothered hearing me about it.
Yeah.
Because it's like anything. It's something you don't understand.
Right.
It's like you said, fear is, it's something you just don't, it's out there, or you don't understand it, or it's a thing in the bush or something. But if you're on the inside of it, your chances of getting killed in a car, in fact, if you have to be a leader like you do today, and you have to do calm. I mean, the employees are going to panic, but they got to take public transportation, get home, and I get them all together. And even if I don't even believe it myself, you gotta say, really, your chances of getting killed in public transportation are probably higher than which is true, right? But anyway, I think it's this. There's something about
That's a good point.
I think it's this not knowing. That's
all
I can describe.
So true. We're all
going to
get the car and go home.
and it's probably yours. If you're on a bicycle, I'm sure it's your chances of getting killed 10 times. But it is, but you just don't.
It's part of life.
I guess all I can say is I don't know how to explain it. It's just if you're on the inside of it. Everyone got on with life.
Right? Yeah.
Unpleasant to hear is if you're okay with it. Could it be that you were othering them and this is a Caucasian person and you're thinking this is more likely to happen to me now?
Mm-hmm.
It's a legitimate fear because that's our brain's way of protecting our emotions. We are there. Oh, it's just happening to those people, not to us.
But I think he was saying he was in China
right.
In the middle of the SARS epidemic.
My wife and my son, and he had to go to school.
Right.
But
you are not yourself Chinese, I think, if I'm
not. No, I'm not.
Exactly. But here, it's somebody who we identify with as our community in a different way.
Whatever the reasons are.
I don't think it's that, because before we went recently, 2 weeks ago, to Thailand and Cambodia, the WHO came out with it's a global thing in emergency, which just meant that they were mustering resources all over, all the countries. But it's still, all my friends were calling me and said, "Are you crazy? You wouldn't go?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't think so." And then my kid said, "Well, you go or not? We're going." And I said, "Well, I'll let them go. They get safe, right?" Even though she's a surgeon, but still. So then we went. But seriously, when we were there, we just had a blast. And people were wearing masks everywhere. And, and I didn't get a cold even. And I told my daughter, "This is it. I've got it, That's all in my head. This is what you get. You're fine. You're just tired. It's not the coronavirus." And then I saw the temples, and we were just in the present moment. Had a blast. But here, before we left, I'm so frightened. And then my friend Valerie actually said, "You're gonna more likely die of a car accident than in Thailand, so just go, So else I want to say, having practiced with fear is that trying to arrange the future in a certain way, so it all comes out the way you want. My practice has taught me that so few times, because there is no future. Mm. I mean, seriously, that's the thing that I'm learning, trying to learn over and over again. This is all. Maybe coronavirus will deal with it then. That can be your present. Right? And so, for everything, just letting go, and you can't make the chess pieces so right that your life's always going to be the way you want.
And that the things that we really rely on, we will still have, no matter what. No matter what circumstances we're facing, we will have practice, we will have zazen, we will have sangha, we will have the mystery of life, you know? Like, I may be screaming as I go down in a plane, but it's okay.
Survival rates of plane crashes have gone up markedly over the past
year. And there is another way to go down.
Does it help? Does not help. Does not help.
Sorry. Show you there's another way to go down. There was this Japanese guy that went down on the plane. I never forget the story. I must have read it 30 years ago. But he actually, when the plane was going down, he wrote a note to his loved ones.
Wow.
I mean, that's another way to die.
True. Sure.
Yeah, but that the same thing. Your chances of falling down in the bathroom or getting killed are greater than
right.
The plane. So it's all in your mind.
It is. Yeah, it
I'm
is.
Just saying, the reason I give that example is I'm convinced that it was all in my mind, because if you're in it, you don't think about it. Same as you're in the bathroom every day, you don't think about, well, I'm going to fall down and get killed here today. But on an airplane, you think about it, right? I don't know what it is. It's something.
I think in a lot of ways the biggest aspect of fear is probably the fact that you don't know or you can't do anything about it, because a lot of times I would agree, like when you're in something, it's there and you just got to deal with it some way or another. When it's something that's maybe a little bit further away, you really just don't know, and that's really what allows you to build up more than anything.
I don't know, it really helps me to go, I'll deal with that when it happens. I mean, I we all have a lot of those things right now. And personally, I also have a husband who's 70 and smokes a lot. And, you know, it's kind of like, there's a lot of, I could think about that a lot. But in another sense, it's like, I will deal with the bad situation when it eventually happens. I mean, let's just... You know, why ruin today thinking about that? So, Ruth, you had your...
Oh, our society has some phobia around scarcity. Mm-hmm. So this feeds
into, yeah.
But from the past Dharma talks, the last few months, in regards to climate change, just find a little something for yourself to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like Pat said, keep washing your hands maybe a little bit more, and like you said, when you're in it, it's the not knowing that can feed the fear. So the other day, I called our three Oregon representatives in D.C. and said, do not give this administration a blank check, because they're not going to be experts. And I mean, WHO isn't coming out with the stuff we're hearing. So, but, in my Asian friends that I go to class with, you know, they're feeling the prejudice.
Yeah.
I keep thinking of phrases that stay in my mind, because I only see a few words at one time, and nothing is begrudged.
Hmm.
So, courage.
Thank you.
We all have.
So, two positive things that we can do that I have been actually thinking about doing for a long time, but now it seems like, well, cool, now we kind of have a motivation. And one, frankly, is the coffee cup thing. I think it'd be really fun to see people bring in their mugs and, you know, and I don't know, we can't really do this here, but I always imagined, like, you know, those pegs on the wall where you can hang the mugs and like, and then when you're like, maybe it's 3 weeks and you're not here, but your mug is here. Like, we won't forget you because your mug is here. And like, you know, it's kind of this interesting way of connection and bring in funny mugs or something like that. So there's that plus, and I'm kind of throwing this out there is like, does anybody feel like taking this on as a project? We don't have internet access at this building. We could get it. I don't know how much it would be. It would take some research, like what would be the best company, blah, blah, blah. How much is it going to cost? But if we had internet access, then we could live stream some of our talks and classes. So say somebody was sick and they were feeling like they shouldn't come, then they can, because I use Zoom video conference so that, you know, we could see who was here, who was listening in, like on the screen, and then they could, you know, there could be a camera aimed at the speaker or whatever. And I'm sure that Pat's been wishing for this for a long time.
I really value if it wasn't the commute on Tuesday night, I would be here more often. The Sunday thing is really works for me in time wise and schedule wise. But I value the online meditation so much and the idea that I could attend virtually
that is what brought me here versus the other places in and around.
Right.
Absolutely. The ability to be able to connect even if I was sick, because there's lots of time around. I will not come just because I'm sick, you know.
And I want to attend the precepts classes and then I could.
So how about two people to research the internet and like there's gonna be some tech crap. There's gonna be like where is the router, and we're gonna need a Ethernet cable. Where are we gonna? What laptop are we gonna use? Does it have a webcam? Where do we set it up? Blah blah blah. It's not that big a deal, but it's gonna be something. So.
You had me look into the internet thing a couple of years ago, and I stalled out on, oh God, what is the telecom infrastructure in the building? Because there's like four telco boxes back in the furnace room.
I don't know. Generally speaking, we're probably only served by one or two companies, and then they would come out and let us know. Yeah. So, Mark?
But don't know.
Yeah.
You have a studio set up that you do this, you know, the morning sit, and from a visual standpoint, what we have here is what you have at home in your office.
Yeah.
And so to replicate doing that here.
No, this would be like live streaming this. This would be like live streaming Tuesday class.
Okay, so you're talking about having an audience, mm-hmm. the Sangha here. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Now I understand better.
So when you you would actually be able to listen in if you were too far away, you were sick, whatever, and maybe other people who, you know, maybe they're far away. And there's a lot of sanghas that do this now. I mean, like when I gave the Dharma talk down at San Francisco Zen Center, they live streamed it. So volunteer? No, come on, Pat, you gotta help.
I don't put energy into it. I don't have the expertise.
You don't have the tech stuff.
I mean, I can certainly ping the telecom companies, but I really don't know what to do about the building. I don't
Well, they would tell us. I mean, they came out when Frontier started me. They came out and put a box on my house and all that kind of stuff. So it might be a little spendy, but maybe we could have a little crowdfunding project for it. So they could do it.
I'll work on this. Mark?
Do you get full phone service here?
We used to.
Basically, we could take out everything that's back there and start over. That's what we're going to have to do anyway.
All right. So Bob, Pat, and Mark collaborating with. Yay! All right. Thank you all for. Oh, I had to. Sorry. I'll have a formal end to the Dharma talk. So just sit tight for a moment. Thank you. abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.